All right. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, also from my side. Just in order to keep the momentum and the livelihood of the previous debate in the first session, we would like to more or less move seamlessly on to the next session, to session two. And I just see that former EU Commissioner Laszlo Andor has joined us. A very warm welcome to you as well. Thanks for joining us here. And yes, it is my pleasure to chair this second session called The European Labour Market, Moving It Closer Together. And if you have read the agenda precisely, then you will have noted the question mark behind Moving It Closer Together. So let's see whether this will be maintained during the session or whether it will change its shape. My name is Eric Tode. I'm working with the Bertelsmann Foundation in Germany as a senior expert for employment and labor policies. And just so you know who is dealing with you here. And I'm not quite sure, actually, if the organizers had this in mind, but the sequence of the sessions, to me at least, actually fit quite nicely. Because now that we have assessed where the energy in future years will be coming from, we are now dealing with the topic on how to use the energy in a broader sense, of course. And that is, of course, to tackle the European unemployment malaise. Last year, around 26 million people in the European Union have been out of work. And since 2008, this means an increase of more than 9 million people. And this is roughly the total population of Austria or Sweden, for that matter. So just think about that for a second. And it's not only the aggregate level that is worrisome, but also the growing disparities between member states. Whereas in 2008, unemployment rates within the EU ranged between 3 and 10% from the best performing country to the worst performing. In 2014, you could observe anything between 5 and 27%. So the spread over this 7-year or 6-year period basically has tripled. So if you take that into account, then you can see that Europe's labor markets, at the moment at least, are growing apart, if anything, rather than moving closer together. The underlying problems are, of course, as you know, manifold, to put it mildly. Of course, the ongoing crisis and especially the lack of aggregate demand are still a drag on the labor market. And in addition, the crisis has made structural issues evident in a rather blunt way. The mismatch on the labor market has risen sharply in terms of qualifications, in terms of occupations, and also in terms of geographic dimensions. And finally, sizable and persistent labor market imbalances between member states make successful adjustments more difficult and dampen the prospects for a strong and broad recovery. So this seems to be a kind of a vicious circle that we have already entered here. And as you all know, the many proposals for tackling the challenges outnumber the underlying issues by a large margin, and any debate that tries to capture each and every aspect is likely to get lost by not seeing the wood for the trees anymore. So therefore, today in this session here, we aim to discuss a selection of rather specific levers that bear sound potential for moving the member states' labor markets closer together in the direction of one European labor market, and thus effectively alleviating high unemployment and growing inequality. So to be more precise, and Art has already touched upon this, we are going to focus on geographic labor mobility within the EU, on the prospects of a European unemployment insurance scheme and the provision of professional skills and qualifications. That being said, we are, of course, also free to discuss other topics that are interrelated with these three major issues. Okay, so much for a short introduction into the topic here. And now it is my great pleasure to introduce you to our panelists. And, of course, ladies first. To my right, we have Ruth Pasermann. She is deputy head of the cabinet of Marianne Thyssen, European Commissioner for Employment, Social Affairs, Skills and Labour Mobility. So very warm welcome to you. you can find more details of the CVs in the document you received. Otherwise, we would run out of time if I would be extensive in describing of all the achievements of our speakers here. To my left, we have Anne Macy. Anne is fairly recently now the chief executive of Confrontation Europe since September 2014, but you have been working at that institution for quite some time. To the very right here on the panel, we have Miroslav Beblavi, who kindly stepped in for Mikkel Barslund. You have still in your documents. Unfortunately, due to illness, Mikkel cannot be here today. He's recovering, so that's good news. And Miroslav will be representing SEPS here today in his function as a senior research fellow. Miroslav also has a very successful career as a politician in Slovakia, where he was the state secretary of the Ministry of Labour, and currently he is still a member of the parliament in Slovakia. And last but not least, of course, Gregory Claes from Bruegel. You are a research fellow at Bruegel, I think, for almost a year right now, and you have held various other posts in being a macroeconomist, so to say, and an expert in finance, so your field of expertise is actually very broad as well. Okay, so just to inform you how the panel is organized, at first, Anne, Miroslav, and Gregory will present their impulse statements, each 5 to 7 minutes long, so the organizers have been very strict on this. And after that, Ruth is going to comment on these impulses and to present the Commission's perspective on what has presented so far. And that will certainly provide us with plenty of things to discuss, where the participation of everybody here in the room, of course, is also strongly encouraged. So, without further ado, I would like to ask our panelists now to enlighten us, and we will start with Gregory. The floor is yours.
Perfect. Thanks very much for this presentation. It's very nice of you. So let me start directly this panel by addressing the long-term reform agenda concerning unemployment, and by discussing the benefits and the drawbacks of creating a European unemployment insurance scheme. So as Eric mentioned already, since the beginning of the crisis of 2008, unemployment has increased massively in Europe, from less than 8% of the workforce to almost 12% today, and also with a broad disparity between countries. So given this disparity and this high level of unemployment in Europe, a debate on new policy tools to address the situation should take place, and I hope it is taking place here today. And one of the solutions that has been proposed to improve economic policy in Europe and also to harmonize European labor markets is the creation of a European unemployment insurance scheme. So in a paper that I have written with two of my colleagues from Bruegel, Joel Darvash and Guntram Wolf, we tried to assess, in fact, the arguments in favor and against such a major European reform. And highlight also the central policy questions that would need to be answered by policy makers before starting to implement such an important reform in Europe. So before discussing the benefits and the drawbacks of this scheme, let me give you a short description of what such a scheme would mean. Basically, the basic idea behind European unemployment insurance is to replace parts or all of national unemployment insurances with a European one. So depending on the design that would be chosen, in fact, there are many designs that can be thought about, the scheme could either permanently cover a basic level of insurance that could be topped by national schemes, or it could be a temporary one with which would be only activated in exceptional circumstances when a rapid increase in unemployment take place in a country. So simple simulations that we have done for this paper and that you can find on our website, for example, suggest that if such a scheme had been in place during the crisis, countries that have been severely hit by the economic crisis and that have seen their unemployment increase rapidly, like Spain, Estonia, Latvia, or Greece, could have received financial inflows up to almost 3% of GDP from such a fund in order to pay the benefits to the unemployed citizens. So it's not something that is insignificant. But two big questions are of central importance before considering putting in place such a scheme. First, I think we need to ask ourselves if we need a stabilization instrument for Europe. And in that case, if we need it, could a European unemployment insurance be that instrument? And the second question that I think is very important is how differently are labor markets organized in Europe? And what are the implications for the creation of such a scheme? And would it be an opportunity also when created such a scheme to reform those labor markets? So turning first to the stabilization question. Basically, the idea of the Maastricht Treaty was to give this role of stabilization to the national budgets. However, we saw two big problems during the crisis. The first one is that the sum of the national fiscal policies did not add up to an aggregate fiscal stance that can be considered as adequate for the euro area. And in fact, from 2011 to 2014, the fiscal policy in the euro area as a whole was clearly procyclical. So this shows that an instrument is missing to influence fiscal policy for the euro area, and European unemployment insurance scheme could be a way, in fact, to contribute to create a euro area wide fiscal stance. Second, a second problem that arose during the crisis is that some countries were hit so severely by the crisis that they had to consolidate much faster than what was desirable. And for the second problem, in fact, a European unemployment insurance scheme could have provided a temporary relief to those countries. The financial support offered by the scheme would allow national government benefiting from it to run a smaller deficit and thereby to reduce the risk of being excluded from financial markets, or it would allow them to implement additional fiscal stimulus in order to reduce the impact of the shocks that they have. So turning to the next issue of the labor market, it's true that the introduction of such a scheme would represent an opportunity also, but also a challenge. An important question is how much labor market institutions need to converge in order to make such a scheme function properly. This is a multi-dimensional issue involving question of the design of the insurance, the desired ability of the scheme to provide a fiscal stabilization, as well as the acceptability of a moral hazard at the level of the individual and among countries. As some of the cost of unemployment would be borne by contributors outside of the country, incentive for national policymakers to address the variety of causes of unemployment could be somewhat reduced. An important trade-off, therefore, emerges. Measures to reduce moral hazard, such as limiting the replacement rate, reduce the stabilization properties of the scheme. But in fact, a solution to this trade-off would be, in fact, to have a fully harmonized labor market across Europe. But labor market institutions matter also for a variety of other reasons. For example, social partners are often involved in very different ways across Europe in the setting of the parameters of unemployment insurances. And in fact, the parameters of the different schemes across Europe varies widely. Some countries have low replacement rate and low contribution rate, while others prefer high contributions to fund higher replacement rate and longer duration. Such differences in level of protection are no accident, of course, but the result of long-standing tradition, histories, and deeply rooted beliefs about how labor market should operate. But such a differences in the way labor market operate are also one of the central problems of Europe's monetary union. Not only is labor mobility low compared, for instance, to the US, as we will see maybe later, but also wage-setting mechanisms are not always adapted to the good functioning of the monetary union. In some countries, wage growth has been persistently deviating from the euro area average, leading to sustained gains or losses in competitiveness that are now one of the causes of substantial economic disequilibria and sustained unemployment level. So introducing a European scheme would therefore represent both an opportunity and a challenge. It would be an opportunity to fundamentally reform inefficient labor markets and to have European states converge towards maybe an optimal one. And it could be a way of improving wage-setting mechanism and increasing the involvement of social partners at the European level. But it's clear that such reform would come at the expense of subsidiarity that now guarantees that labor markets are organized at the national level according to national preferences. So important question would therefore needed to be addressed by European policymakers before creating such a scheme. I see many of them. Would this scheme be for the European Union or the Eurozone? Should labor market institutions be harmonized and should the social dialogue take place at the European level? Are potential persistent transfers acceptable for all countries? Would a common insurance require a common administration of the scheme? What kind of democratic oversight would be needed? Should this scheme have a borrowing facility? Should it be an all-time or catastrophic insurance? What should be the main parameters? What would be the legal framework? So in the papers that we have written, we provide some of the answers to this question, but I think it's also the policymakers that need to address this question and the citizens of Europe who need to see if they want a European unemployment insurance scheme and what kind of insurance do they want. So in conclusion, I believe that the debate on additional stabilization instrument is necessary for the euro area and that the European unemployment insurance scheme could represent a first step to provide such a tool and to share risk across Europe. But perhaps more importantly, it could have the potential to trigger deep changes in European labor markets. And this could help substantially improving national labor market, render them more European, and ensure that wage and social policies are in line with the need of monetary union. Such a reform, however, would impose, of course, some constraint on long-standing national traditions and preferences. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Gregory, for this very concise overview, and I'm quite sure that we will have to go into more detail in the subsequent discussions. But for now, let's move on to Miroslav, I think, who will pick up on the same issue and then extend the talk to other topics.
Thank you. My colleague was certainly right that the European unemployment insurance is an extremely complex topic, and he, I think, tried to paint the complexity for you. I can only support that given the two studies we have done so far on the topic, one for the Parliament, one for the Commission, which were each quite long, and despite that they were considered to be very short. And the Commission actually has now commissioned us to write the report over the next year and a half on the topic, which I think will end up being about this tall. So it truly is a complex topic. So let me try to simplify it for you in the 3 minutes that I want to devote to it. I will make the following argument. The key decision about European unemployment insurance is not whether to do it, but how to do it. And I think there are two main options, and these two main options, which one of them will be chosen by those who will push this idea, will actually determine, I think, both whether it's actually accepted, but also what it will do if it's done. And my argument is that the European unemployment insurance makes sense only if it makes a difference. If it's to be another distributive mechanism that doesn't change much, then, you know, there certainly the political and transaction costs are not worth it. But you can have two kinds of differences. One, which is associated with this sort of Europeanization of unemployment insurance, which basically means that either you replace the national unemployment insurance with the European version or you supplement it with the European version, but you have a European unemployment insurance that works on a daily basis and it distributes from citizens in country A to citizens in country B on a daily and individual basis, is that that actually is not likely to make much of a fiscal difference, because for a given amount of, you know, resources that you are distributing, you're not likely to make much of a difference in the real problem. So it's more of another case of fiscal churn. Why is this attractive, however, for many people, given the fact that for a given amount of money, it will actually not change much in a crisis, which is why we're arguing for macroeconomic stabilization. And the reason for that is that many people see it as a Trojan horse for harmonization of social security systems and labor market regulations in Europe. So you actually don't like, or you don't care about the unemployment insurance per se or its stabilization impact, but you care about it as a way of getting what you want. If that's what you want, then this supranationalization of unemployment insurance scheme is the way to go. The other point of view is that actually what you're saying you want, which is the macroeconomic stabilization and crisis, given the asymmetric shocks that Europe is undertaking, then actually the reinsurance mechanisms, or what is often called the tornado fund, is much more appropriate, which means that the European level doesn't redistribute on on an individual and regular basis, but it actually collects money, and we can discuss, and that's the complexity about how it should do so, and only distributes to the country in years where the country is in real macroeconomic trouble. So the result of that is that you get much more of a punch for a given amount of money, so you can really help Spain or Greece or whoever, or even, we did the calculations, the Baltic countries would be major beneficiaries at certain periods, and also at certain periods even some of the Nordic countries would be beneficiaries because they also had, for example, if you look at Nordic countries in the early 90s, they would have been a perfect beneficiary of this tornado fund at the time. I would argue it's politically more palatable because you don't have to mess with the national unemployment insurance systems much, and you also makes it more of a stabilization impact. But the disadvantage is, or disadvantage depending on UK, is that you don't actually use it as a Trojan horse for harmonization of social security and labor market systems. So I think that is the biggest choice. Do you really want something that stabilizes, or do you want something that harmonizes? And I think we have to choose, or we will have neither. But I think that is the essential choice between what we call a Brussels rain fund and a tornado fund, and you have to choose one or the other. Moving on to mobility, I think one of the main problems with regard to the mobility policy debate at the European level is that we ignore the evidence about what actually drives mobility in Europe as a sort of primary drivers. And if you look at primary drivers, I think it's fairly clear it's four things. It's language, it's wage differentials, and to some extent, but much less, unemployment differentials. It's the education, in the sense that if you go study somewhere, the likelihood that you will stay there is much higher than if you don't. But of course, this is only practically open for people who study higher education, which, given the massification of higher education, can be massive, but it leaves behind the rest of the people with upper secondary education. So if you look at these things and you really see that this is what's driving whether people are willing to move across Europe for jobs or not, then there is actually not that much that the European Union can do on these things. I mean, it can support language, instruction, but given the fact that quantity of language instruction is in a very poor relationship with the quality of the language command, because, as we know, in France there is, I think, 12 years of English, but that's not generally reflected in the in the English as you encountered it in France, whereas the Scandinavians have much less of that. But whether it's because of the subtitled movies or the linguistic closeness, you get a very different result in any survey you do. So, but I'm certainly not sure there is something the EU can immediately do about that. Education, of course, because of Erasmus and other means, that's something the EU can actually make a lot of difference on. But the problem there, I think, is that, as I say, it only concerns higher education effectively. I mean, you can have Grundtvigs and other Leonardo da Vinci's, but that's, by definition, I think, much less likely to be successful on that. Whereas the things that we are focusing on in European debates are the things which are much less important. Portability, of course, of systems and benefits is essential. I agree with that. But first of all, we have moved a long way on that, so it's not like we're starting from zero. Then I think the impact could be fairly strong. And I don't think there is much evidence that moving forward will produce much of a bang. I mean, I'm still for it. I like it, and I think it will be beneficial. It's just we cannot expect miracles from that. So it's just important to have realistic expectations. And the other point I would make is that this sort of recognition of education, which is being touted as one of the key things, and a lot of money is invested in that, I'm fairly skeptical about that for reasons I'll try to share very shortly and then to finish my presentation. If you're a British employer looking at the young Greek woman paperwork submitting for work, or Slovak young male paperwork, it's not that you are lacking a computer system which you punch their diploma and it will tell you, oh, this is equivalent to a British O-levels. If you are an employer, and I don't know how many of you, I guess most of you in this room have hired people in the past, or are hiring them maybe in the moment, you want to know the quality of the education. You want to know what it actually means if someone has a diploma from Collegia de something. I mean, what does it mean? What that person can do? Is it a quality institution? Is it an institution for losers, to be honest? I mean, is it an institution that delivers certain types of skills? I mean, that's what you're looking at as an employer. I mean, you're being very pragmatic when you're hiring people. So, and I fully acknowledge that that's something that's probably impossible to do at the European level, both politically and technically. But unless you do that, I don't think many employees in British Midlands will be, you know, looking at all these, you know, EU-funded systems and trying to see whether the Greek diploma matches certain type of British O levels. I mean, if you talk to British employers or Slovak employers, they're quite bewildered by already the British diplomas. I mean, you know, so even that is as the proliferation of vocational things is, for example, happening in the UK. You know, a British employer saying, we don't understand these things. You know, they come from our own country. So I think we need to be much more realistic about that. And the final fact I will tell you from a research paper we've done is that when you look at EURES, which I think is one of the actually best interventions the EU has done and can be doing, you can see that the German employers enter formal educational requirements only into a 10% of their ads on EURES. Because the German education system is so structured that they actually understand very well what they want from German graduates, you know. But once they move beyond Germany, when they're putting it into EURES, they actually don't know what to put in there, and they might not even care. So I think that's the best evidence that, and this is not going to help by, you know, another round of investment into the mutual, you know, understanding of diplomas kind of thing. So I would argue for focusing more on think about what the EU can do about education mobility and maybe discussing whether there is any role for Europe in the quality of language skills across Europe, which, as I say, is a very sensitive area, but I think probably one where we could make a lot of difference. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Miroslav, for the very frank language in your presentation. And yeah,
I'm still more of a national politician than a European analyst, so...
That's okay. So, Anne, now it's you.
Good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here today. Coming back to what Mikhail and Miroslav and Greg have shown, mobility and a European unemployment scheme are key objectives of a European labor market. The rationale is economic, but also demographic and social. Yet, taking a step back, and looking at the overall approach, my take is that we probably cannot look at mobility and a European unemployment scheme in isolation without asking ourselves what is the end goal of a European labor market. Well, I'd say it's to prepare for a European competitive economy where we can live the way we want. Now, coming back to mobility and a European unemployment scheme, you mentioned it. We need three things. We need one, easy and quick recognition of qualification, transportability of social security rights, so maybe larger, and knowledge of languages. First one, recognition of qualification. Legal recognition already exists, and you mentioned it with a lot of pragmatism. We've been told that there are huge limitations in implementation. We need transportability of a European unemployment scheme, but also of health insurance, pension rights, vocational training rights, and or qualifications. As a worker, I need the whole package to be mobile. And of course, talking with the national labor ministers, they are telling us, look, we need to start somewhere. It's too complicated to tackle everything. But if we don't, we are not going to move very much further. And knowledge of languages, because we're so diverse. As you mentioned, we're all speaking English here, speaking Franglish. But in our countries, especially mine, I fully acknowledge that, most people don't. So you've got to speak the language if you're going to move there, except in specific places. So maybe more important than geographic mobility, even more so is professional mobility. I would see three reasons for that. One is the change in the nature of work in today's world. Second is the growing gaps you mentioned, growing economic gaps within Europe that call for maybe active solidarity, social investment. And the third one is gaps between national social systems, which lead to a perception of a race to the bottom in Europe, which is dramatic. Coming back to the first one, the change of the nature of work in today's world, maybe this is the key, because it makes lifelong learning an imperative. So that's why reforming training systems, profound reforms, is key if we've got to prepare for the transformation of technological and information world. Coming to the second reason, growing economic gaps within European countries, it is even threatening the integrity of the Eurozone and the European Union. So these growing gaps might make permanent, massive, passive transfers almost unsustainable. So we, especially since there is such a massive underinvestment in social capital in many countries in Europe, in the periphery, and especially in the people who would most need it. So we might want to consider, as we are trying to do, actually, social investment, and this could be backed by the long-term strategic investment fund that is currently being set up. Maybe this would need to be strengthened, because if reforming structural funds in the way we would need to do would probably go beyond the current multi-annual framework. And last but not least, the gaps between national systems tend to lead to a perception, at least, of a race to the bottom that is very damaging. This is why maybe a European labor market should also seek a convergence on four pillars. This is adding to the complexity, right? Convergence on workers' rights, convergence on stakeholders' dialogue, on the sustainability, at least, of our national social security systems, and also on fiscal convergence, because what is paid on labor cannot be another opportunity for a race to the bottom. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Anne, for this very pronounced advocacy for convergence within Europe. And so now it's over to you, Boot. Does this all relate to your work program?
Thank you. Yeah, well, actually, I think I will start from the last intervention. Convergence. I think the key point is that my commissioner has really wants to focus on is the issue of convergence. There's been a great divergence in performance in the labour markets in these years, as was mentioned in the introduction. And what can we do to bring it more to improve the convergence between member states, not only in outcomes, which is what you imagine, so to bring unemployment down in the countries where it is extreme, but also in the workings of the labor markets. I mean, when we talk about structural reforms and labor market reforms, what we are really saying is that we think that they should be, although there are some national institutions which and characteristics which remain, there are nonetheless some aspects which need to move in the same direction. And this, for example, to mention two points that we have already been insisting in the previous years, but we'll continue to do so. I would mention segmentation of the labour markets and the issue of taxes on labour. Segmentation of the labour market in the sense that there are some countries where it is clearly there is a clear division between the insiders and the outsiders, and the Commission is really driving as much as possible, pushing for reform in these member states so that there is a single fluid labour market that will allow, which therefore means possibly less protection for the insiders, but also more protections for the outsiders. So I know that this is also very often sounds like Commission wants to reduce protection for workers, but what we're actually saying is that also the outsiders have to have a chance to improve and to have a more protection and to be employed and to be in employment and to improve their situation. The other point I mentioned was the issue of tax on labor, which also goes back to one of the points that Anne made about fiscal convergence, in a way. We are saying that the fiscal setup should be, we are consistently saying this practically to every country, that the fiscal setup should be by moving taxation away from labor and towards other sources. In some cases, it is clearly extreme because the way the society has been organized is that there was more or less full employment and that therefore all the, for example, social security contributions are paid from the employed people, and this is the way that this has been organized. But it doesn't work in the current world because it ends up being a competitiveness factor in those countries, the cost of labor, and at the same time it is not necessarily helping the workers and the sustainability because of the increase of the unemployment rate. So, in general, less people in employment. To go back, convergence. Convergence in the labour market is also about the convergence in the way labour markets are structured. I mean, are overall structured. And I think we are intervening in this by saying that member states should have a fruitful social dialogue, for example. So, of course, there are very different traditions on this in different member states. But this is also something that this commission has said that it would very much stand for. Other point, the minimum wage. The Commission has also welcomed that countries have a minimum wage and that this idea of a minimum wage is spread through. So basically what I'm trying to say is that I think this Commission is going to work on improving convergence not only through the outcomes, but also in the way the labour markets work on the various aspects. And this leads me to perhaps the first speaker who mentioned the issue of the fact that the European Unemployment Insurance could be an opportunity for labour market reform. I would put it the other way around. First, we do the labour market reforms and we assure a certain level of convergence, and then we can think about an unemployment insurance instrument at European level. Of course, there is the other issue of the stabilisation instrument, I mean the need of a macroeconomic stabilisation, which I personally very strongly believe in, but I am not... The Commission at the moment is considering various options, I mean, of what this macroeconomic stability... the fact that you need some kind of macroeconomic stability mechanism, of course the unemployment insurance is one possibility. The kind of not really unemployment insurance that you mentioned, in the sense of a fund, let's say a guarantee fund is another, and there are also other options on the table. So for the moment, this is a very open discussion, and I think I would leave it at that. Perhaps I've been speaking already too much. So I move to the mobility point. Mobility will never be enormous. We're never going to have enormous flows of mobility in Europe. And to be honest, it's just as well. I mean, we're starting to have problems not only with the destination countries, that's what you all know about, but also with the origin countries. There is a clear demographic issue in Europe. And, you know, if all the young people of working age population leave, this is creating a problem. So I think the Commission will continue to promote mobility. It is very important, one of the four freedoms. It is important also from the economic point of view. But, okay, exactly, from the economic point of view, it's never going to be so important. I mean, let's just tell it clearly. Yeah? I'm sorry, I'm being a bit blunt. It's never going to be enough to stabilize, to act as a stabilization mechanism within Europe because the flows are not big enough. What can we do to improve? Of course, we can work on all the aspects that have been mentioned. We are working on it. Improving the portability of rights, more widely than simply, I mean, all the rights of the Social Security, which is, of course, also linked to what I said at the beginning about some harmonization, or not really harmonization, but convergence of the rights, of the fact that some rights exist, otherwise it can't work. Education, well, higher education, okay, you mentioned Erasmus, but actually Erasmus is probably the most successful program of the European Union, you know, in every single domain. So I think we should continue investing in that. You surely read about that, you know, 1 million babies born from Erasmus or something like that, yeah? So there is a clear...
It's a social policy instrument.
Exactly, a social policy instrument. So, portability, recognition of qualifications. I see your point. I have to say, on the fact that employers are actually looking for something that they can understand, and so now I'm going to think. Maybe you have good ideas of how this could be done beyond the sort of legal recognition, so that it can actually lead to progress. I mean, maybe twinning or something. I don't know. And finally, what else I wanted to say? Yeah. Sorry about that. Yeah, and then of course, yes, the point of in the issue of mobility, one has to think, indeed, also at the very much at the longer term. Longer term is the demographic challenges that I mentioned before, but it's also the technological change, the fact that we need, I mean, the whole thing has to be thought a bit more, you know, now you can get your radiographies by sending an email and, you know, doing the whole thing, you know, long distance, you can consult a doctor long distance, you can, I mean, what can we imagine as the future of work and therefore also the future of mobility and mobile workers when you think of the technological change and changing nature of work, which links then again a bit to the points that Anne made on training, lifelong learning, etc. I stop. I haven't talked enough.
Thanks a lot, Ruth, for adding these insights. And now we have what was to be expected, namely that we have a very rich bouquet of very different issues here. And they are all worth being touched upon. But for the moment, I would really like to dwell a little bit on the European Unemployment Insurance Scheme and maybe to go a bit more into detail there. And first of all, maybe a rather general question, and this has always puzzled me, I have to admit, because frequently the European Unemployment Insurance Scheme is coming up when we talk about the general labor market crisis in Europe. But what I have learned is that the unemployment insurance scheme is, and we've heard this just a few moments ago, is more of an automatic stabilizer, so in order to flatten out cyclical fluctuations between different member states. And I'm constantly wondering, how can this work out as a device for alleviating the structural problems we have on the national labor markets within the European Union? Because from a logical point of view, I think this is at odds in a certain sense. And so I would like to know what Gregory and maybe also Miroslav have to say about that.
Do you want me to start? No, it's true that one of the main features that I have mentioned that I think deserves some attention, and I think one of the main goals of a European unemployment scheme would be to be an automatic stabilizer. But as Miroslav also mentioned, there are different version of this European unemployment insurance scheme. Either you do a catastrophic scheme, like for the ones that he called Tornado, and in that case you don't mess up with labor legislation, and you leave to the countries to take care of the reforms that are necessary to make their labor market function better, or you have a more paternalistic approach where you have a basic scheme where you would need some day daily intervention by the European Unemployment Insurance Scheme. And in that case, it's true that to make that work and to put that in place, as Ruth says, maybe you would need like some convergence before. And in that case, you would have to mess up a bit more with the labor legislation. But in my view, in fact, in my opinion, I think that it's more a paternalistic approach. It means that you don't believe that countries can arrange themselves and can make the right reforms to make their unemployment their labor market institution optimal. So I think I agree with Miroslav in a sense is that I think that this catastrophic scheme is more in line first with the goal of having a stabilization mechanism and also more in line with the subsidiarity principle which says that those labor institutions and labor policies should be decided at the national level.
European unemployment insurance per se is not a tool for structural reforms. It is, I mean, you also don't use it at the national level as a tool of structural reform. You use it as a stabilization mechanism, whether both macroeconomically but also individually. I mean, the traditional social policy argument for unemployment insurance is that, you know, workers or individuals are either not forced to take a job that's not matched well to them because they are under liquidity constraint, and so they don't lose the human capital, you know, because of that. So that, and then you have the stabilization and standard of living stabilization argument. So I would say per se the European level is there because we have seen that, and that's true also for the US. If you look at the US states, not just for Europe, is that in a major crisis, in a major recession, countries can get into liquidity constraint at the national level. So if you don't have a European level that can support that, countries can act actually pro-cyclically, which can be bad both macroeconomically, but also at the, you know, for their own workers and individuals in these terms. So that's the primary argument for why I discuss this idea. Of course, you can attach a labor market reform conditionality on top of that if you want to, and you can attach that to any version of the European unemployment insurance. You can say, if you want the money, this is what you have to do. You can do that ex ante, as Ruth was suggesting. So you can say entry into this mechanism is conditional on fulfilling certain conditions because we only want in the club, you know, those who are ready. But to my mind, that to some extent defeats a little bit the purpose, but it's certainly doable. Or you can do ex post. You can say once someone is drawing on the fund in any way, or if, you know, if the balance is larger than something, then you have to present a plan of reform. So you can do various kinds of conditionalities on that. However, I would say two things. One is that, Europe doesn't have a long experience of these types of conditionalities. We have actually only started doing them in the crisis since 2009. But there is a large global experience with conditionalities, which we have with the World Bank and in the IMF over the last 50 or 60 years. And the experience is not good. I mean, the experience is not good in the sense that it doesn't really work for various reasons, which probably we don't want to get into this debate, or it's quite weak. So I'm personally a skeptic on these type of conditionalities working. If you look at deep-seated institutional reforms, very complex and very country contingent and specific. So it's not about achieving a certain inflation level or achieving certain, you know, interest. It's about really trying to redo the country. I mean, I haven't, but, you know, Europe has tried to redo Greece for 5 years now with really a huge hammer in their hand, and it hasn't worked, you know, that much to be honest. So I'm personally, you know, not that much of a fan of this adding more and more conditionalities to these issues. The other thing I would say is that we are already trying that in terms of structural fund conditionality. We are now for the first time attaching conditionality to structural fund disbursements of similar kind of labor market and skills reforms, etc. So I would argue that it might be prudent to wait how that works out before we actually begin to attach conditionality to, you know, to other instruments that we are creating and that might not be best suited for that.
Maybe of course, a very important topic in that respect is the legitimacy of such conditionality proposals. One thing that has to be kept in mind in addition when it comes to convergence is, of course, the different roles of the social partners in the different EU member states. And this certainly applies to the European Unemployment Insurance Scheme. As you all know, for example, in the Ghent system, trade unions basically run the unemployment insurance scheme. So this adds another level of difficulty, of challenges, so to say. And I would assume that the same would be true when it comes to the professional, to the recognition of professional qualifications. For example, in Germany, the dual vocational training system is basically run by the social partners. So what, perhaps Ruud, what is your approach to that? How would the Commission go about the involvement of the social partners in such convergence debates?
Okay, this is what we're trying to do now. The first thing is to relaunch the social dialogue at European level. And the second, this is the first step. The second step is to involve the social partners on the, to make sure that social partners are involved in the national level in the sort of economic governance discussion, so in the European semester, let's say. So that's the second step. And then the third step is to look at how we can involve. I should say. When I say relaunch the social dialogue at European level, I should mention that it's also about that it is about involving social partners in. Anyway, this is the way I see it. I mean, the way my commissioner see it. I'm not sure, not necessarily it's what's going to happen. But the involvement of the social dialogue should be of the social partners throughout the files of the commissions where they may have something to say, not only on labor market issues. I think this is very important. For example, we mentioned before energy union. So, I mean, just to make, since this is what we were talking about before, so what have social partners to say on energy union? So this is the vision that we have for the EU level. For the national level, the key point now is to ensure a greater involvement of social partners in the economic governance. This will, of course, lay bare the differences between the national institutional setup, which is fine. I mean, this is the way it is. The Commission thinks that social partners have a role to play, which also means that in some cases they probably have a greater role to play than what they have played so far. This would then require, I would say, analysis at national level, basically. I mean, what is the role of social partners at national level? What's their representativeness, etc.? So I think this is where we are.
Mm-hmm. And before you join in on that topic, maybe yet another aspect, especially when it comes to social partners, but also when it comes to national governments, there seems to be what Wolfgang Streeck has called institutional nationalism. So that there is a tendency that member states, countries, actors in these countries want to maintain their power, of course, and their position in the bargaining. And I think this needs to be overcome when you want to have a real convergence in various aspects. Do you have any ideas on how to achieve this?
Mm-hmm. Well, on the first point, I'm glad to hear that the Commission is really looking forward to relaunching social dialogue. Probably in the spring, I heard, because it's also birthday. It's the 30 years of Val Duchesse, who was the launch of during the Delors European Commission of European social dialogue. So that's one point. I fully agree with Ruth. If we really want to have a chance of reactivating dialogue at European level, we would need to try to enlarge the scope or the parameter and try to have them, maybe not just social partners, but also stakeholders, including other players and regions, so we could have a broader region first. But this is on players, but on the topics, not just labor market reforms, but also what are their prospects on productivity gains? What are their prospects on employment? Which is a challenge, of course, because they have to question themselves on every single player on their ability for perspective, which is always a tougher issue. On the other aspect, institutional nationalism, I'm not sure I have the answer. I believe, to put it frankly, that in the way of the European construction, typically in a number of times, member states have stood in the way of going further and tend to... I don't know the way for it, but to prevent other players in different countries from interacting also. So not sure I have the answer for that. Or maybe
it's a tough one, yes, yeah. Please.
Just two short comments. I mean, if you want some sort of institutional convergence, there are certainly two risks you should take in mind. One is... you know, what's the point, end point of the convergence? How do you decide that? Because there is a tendency, I mean, I remember when I was a young economist in early 2000s, I remember being from transition countries that, you know, in early 90s, the Czechs were the best and the Hungarians were the best and the Slovaks were the best and then now the Poles are the best. And I've been thinking, okay, so everyone's moment in time comes, you know, if you just wait long enough. And it's the same with the German vocational education model. I remember 15 years ago, you could find a lot of literature saying that this is a very inflexible, stratified model, unsuitable for the current world where you need much more general skills and that, you know, the Germans will certainly have to change their education model, otherwise they're going to languish, you know, in abyss forever. And now, you know, lots of people want to export that to the rest of Europe. And, you know, I think the truth is somewhere in between, but what I'm just trying to say is that I think we need to be very careful about imposing institutions which are very long-term based on short-term evaluations of their effectiveness. So that's one risk. How do you choose the best model? What's the best model and how you should do that? And I would argue for a much longer horizon. But the other thing is also what sociologists call isomorphism, which is that you imitate how something looks and then the question is whether it actually works the same or whether it just looks the same. And, you know, German way of, for example, running vocational education is deeply embedded in the way their society, you know, in the way of the German society and the economy. And you can export the laws to Spain or to Slovakia, but that doesn't mean you will be able to export the rest. And so, we are, I think, already observing, given the qualitative nature, for example, many of the Commission's recommendations or the Council recommendations to countries that there is a lot of, you know, a lot of facade, and then there is what's really behind that, and that doesn't always match perfectly. And, you know, again, being from a post-communist country, I'm fairly sensitive to that because I've seen 40 years of that being, you know, this apart. And while, of course, that's fortunately not the problem in a free society, the more you push for institutional convergence, I think the more you have a risk of the formal convergence without the informal convergence. And that, again, doesn't say that you shouldn't do anything, but it just says you should be careful about that. And you should try to assess what's more exportable and what's more convergible in reality and where you can only get a facade. And I think, you know, what we've seen over the last 15, 20 years in Europe is that you can get a lot of convergence on something. So it's not, so you can get a lot of real movement and traction. But then you can also do a lot of formal convergence. And you know, I think our common objective should be to do the former, not the latter, where, you know, we can politically and socially agree on moving forward.
Okay, thank you very much for this first round of debate. I was informed that we can go a little bit into overtime as lunch is only set for 12:15. And now I would like to open the debate for you all. And please use the microphones that are in your armrests. The lady over there, please. And then the gentleman. Oh, sorry. So maybe first the gentleman over there. Yeah.
Does it work? Yeah, outstanding. No, thank you, Herr Todde. Ms. Pazman mentioned convergence. Let me give you an example of convergence. There, as of the beginning of this year, there's a new German minimum wage, we might be aware. The Czech truck driving companies don't like it so much because they have to pay for their drivers, and they're used to a much lower level of wage. They can't afford it. So that's there you have an example of your convergence. And it's strange that I've only heard the news about the Czech drivers, and my own experience on German roads is there are plenty of Hungarian, Slovak trucks, and I don't know why they're complaining about it. Maybe the trucks have yet to arrive at the border where they're in for an unpleasant surprise. I don't know. But so there's an example of your convergence. But if I can just raise two quick questions. Question of subsidiarity. It's supposed to be a big issue, a big principle for the European Union. We know its benefits. You have different conditions in different countries. Subsidiary contributes to incubators, which states can try out new solutions and perhaps spread best practice. With your plan for the new EU unemployment insurance, why don't you look to the United States, where they've had unemployment insurance ever since the 30s? That's 80 years, and you're probably aware that it's run at the state level. It's determined at the state level what are the qualifications and what you get, and it's very different. Very different, for example, in Alabama than in New York, whereas, of course, it's funded on a block grant level from the federal government, but it's at the state level. So my question is at least in the subject of this discussion, how can it be that the U.S. maybe has a greater commitment to subsidiarity than the European Union that has it in its own literature and charters? My second quick question has to do with the plan with Mr. Klaus mentioned that whereas most unemployment insurance, as we know, is anti-cyclical, there was a strange tendency later on in the crisis of a pro-cyclical policy in the European Union, as if that was also natural. I would submit that it was pro-cyclical because of an explicit austerity policy on the part of European leaders, which is making it pro-cyclical, which we can see reflected in the response to the Greek elections, that no, you will not have any debt relief, you will not have any relief at all, you will do your structural changes, and that will make you better. So I suggest that maybe all of these plans for a unified European Union unemployment insurance maybe are naive or possibly a backdoor attempt to undermine the austerity policy and as such will be recognized by those truly in charge of the European Union and will be quashed forthwith and don't have a chance. Well, thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Have you answered the question? I was going to collect some more. Yes. Okay. So we'll collect some more questions, Lena.
Thank you. I have a microphone now. I'm Anna Ferro from the European Anti-Poverty Network. I was quite surprised that during all interventions, not just in this session, but also in the morning session, the European Union Strategy for Smart, Sustainable and Inclusive Growth, aka Europe 2020, was not mentioned once. So my very first question directly to Ms. Passerman is, are we scrapping this strategy? And function of the answer, I would like to know from other members of the panel, how can, for instance, such a scheme, a European unemployment scheme, contribute to achieving the social targets of Europe 2020, particularly the poverty reduction target, where there is a current shortfall of 8 million people? Thank you very much.
Okay, one more question over there, and then we'll turn to the other side. Yep.
Yes. Okay, I'm Alice Baker Osinga, Foundation Osinga Ares in Dordrecht. It is about, I know Václav Klaus from the beginning when it started long time ago in Czechoslovakia. I'm a friend of Poland also, but my approach is not only social and economic. I studied French and Italian, so I think the cultural approach and the lifestyle you have, that is very important. And now we have the digital possibilities, but even when there are conferences about all we could work together, I think these times have to have a change in mind also, but not like in the United States, as I always saw in Eastern Europe, that they said you have to change your mind. And I think we should not be the United States. We are not that. I'm Dutch, but I know that we are too much cola light, I will say, about it. I think we have, Europe was very important, and we know the history and so on. So please be to the modern times, and then the think tanks are very good, but it is all paperwork and dialogue. But like yesterday, I saw it in Auschwitz. I made the City League Dordrecht-Krakow a long time ago, then it is okay. But people are interested in people, and we should have the storytelling also. So we need Rome, we need Athens, and all this history. And you should not forget it. Now it is just like these times and economics and so on. And then there is poverty, and there is a lot of problems. But really, the whole world is connected now. Think global, act local, and then we should try also to be not so macho against each other, but try to be in Chinese world, it's quite different. Russian world also. We should not scream to each other, and we should be proud of mankind, and then you need also culture. So not only economics, it's not possible. I know the Madriaga Institute and so on. I know Davignon also was building all the time. He was commissioner for culture a long time ago, and he has his experience. But so please think about history also and the future, and our common future will be sustainable, but in relations and different ways to approach each other, and not only with all the robots and so on. I don't like that.
Thanks a lot for the very firm statement. So I think it's you, and then we'll go over to the other panelists.
Okay. So to pick up on some of the questions, well, I hope on all the questions, except clearly there is a clear, the way Europe is organized is that we do have subsidiarities, and just to be very clear, we are aiming for convergence of labor market institutions, we are not aiming for harmonization. And we are not going to legislate on how the unemployment benefit, the national unemployment benefit, has to be organized. So just to be, this is not going to happen. There is a clear role of the member states. Decisions have to be made together. And we're just saying that there has to be, in our opinion, more convergence of labor market institutions to work, in particular, within the Eurozone. I have to say that the comment that was made before by the other panelists resonates immensely with me. I'm Italian originally, and in Italy the saying is, once you make a law, you find a way around the law. So, this is so you know...
exactly.
So, you know, the facade, but so not change the facade, but change what is actually underneath, perhaps without changing the facade. So, this is what we're saying at the European level. And to achieve this, so the improvement of the working of the labor market institutions, we have to have a very good knowledge of the country, an in-depth knowledge of the countries, and absolutely not recommend to every country the same thing in the same way. I completely agree on this, and without doing this, we won't get any progress. Now, on the German minimum wage, of course, I'm aware. For your information, I think there are 10 countries that have complained. The issue is, the issue is the fact that transport trucks also going through Germany would need to apply the German minimum wage. The Commission is very much in favour of the fact that Germany has introduced a minimum wage. There are very few countries now that haven't, really very few, because of a few which don't have a national minimum wage, like Finland and Denmark. They have one agreed between the social partners. So actually, there are very few now that don't. The Commission is nonetheless investigating is the wrong word, really. We are looking at these letters and seeing whether there is indeed an issue in the sense of the internal market. This is all I can say for the moment. Europe 2020. No, the Commission does not intend to scrap the strategy. Europe 2020, innovative, sustainable, and inclusive growth remain the goals. The targets that were set remain the targets, and therefore also the poverty target. What we really have to think is what can we do to improve our policies to move towards these targets and help member states move towards these targets. And this is what we're working on now. Okay.
Okay, thank you very much for the moment. I would suggest that in view of the time, we take two more questions I have already here. Sorry, but the two is enough, I think. And then we have a concluding round here. And maybe also Mr. Andor would like to give us his reflections on the debate so far here. So, but first of all, maybe the gentleman over there.
Okay, John Richardson from the German Marshall Fund. I think it's fair to say that the that the degree of solidarity which we've been able to build up in fiscal terms over the period of the crisis has been limited to a considerable extent by the willingness of certain governments, in particular the German government, to go along with it, pushed by the attitude of German taxpayers to paying fiscal transfers to other parts of Europe. I just want to ask you how you think it would be acceptable politically and feasibly in Germany if, adding to the tax transfers, you also had social insurance contribution transfers, where German social, where German workers would see their social insurance contributions going to unemployment benefit in southern Europe. Do you really think that's feasible?
Thank you very much for the brief question. Now the lady over there.
I'm Girgana Kicheva, Bulgarian Youth Forum. You mentioned the success of the Erasmus program, and we know that its brothers like Youth in Action have also been quite successful. So I'll have a question in a different direction. How do you see the role of non-formal education and the skills it fosters in fighting unemployment? Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Andor? It would be better for the translation, I think. Please.
I came to listen, and I enjoyed immensely the panel, and I find myself here at my previous place. First of all, let me say that together with the Bertelsmann Stiftung, we had to break a little bit of ice in the previous years, but now I think it's really fantastic that practically all think tanks are either thinking or working or have already contributed significantly to this debate on automatic stabilizers in general terms, or concretely on the possibility of EMU unemployment insurance. But please don't forget that this discussion did not start as a social policy debate. It started with a reflection of the previous commission, the Barroso II commission, if you still remember it, a reflection on the economic and monetary union. And the first commission document where this was mentioned and briefly elaborated on was the blueprint on the deep and genuine EMU at the end of 2012. Why is this important? Because first, I think it's crucial to understand the problems and the limitations of the functioning of the EMU, and why it is necessary, as the blueprint and at the same time the four presidents' report outlined it, to start an evolution, a process towards a more sustainable, more balanced structure. And the role of fiscal policy or fiscal capacity in this process is a crucial one, especially now when a certain, I would say, minimalist banking union has already been completed. We have to continue thinking about the possible next steps, because the problems connected with cyclicality and asymmetry in the monetary union are still with us. They've not disappeared. And you know, this needs to be connected with the search for the right instruments, because the EU has structural funds to address the long-term structural challenges, but doesn't have cyclical funds. And the potential of short-term cyclical problems to cause a long-term damage has been underestimated, probably. So we have to reflect on the thoughts and the ideas and the assumptions, not just of the recent period, what went wrong and what went well with the crisis response, but how the EMU was designed since the late 1980s, and especially at the time of Maastricht, which was, in fact, built on the assumption, or I should say the illusion of homogeneity. Now, since there is no homogeneity, and unfortunately the actual functioning of the EMU has the capacity to turn the diversity into divergence, this threatens the stability, the sustainability, and the legitimacy of the whole system. So this is why I think this debate is so important and so timely, and I can only congratulate to you for organizing it.
Thank you very much. So now we have 5 minutes for a concluding round, and I would like to start in reverse order. So this would mean, Ruud, you will be first.
Okay. You want me to conclude? Okay. Well, thank you for the questions and for the very interesting debate. Indeed, perhaps I just pick up then back on the two points that I made already at the beginning. The first point, I would completely support what Mr. Andor just said. The European unemployment insurance debate started absolutely in the framework of the need to stabilize EMU, and that is why I go back to what was said before. We said at the beginning, we need to work on some form of stabilization mechanism for the EMU, and this is what will be work that will continue in the next 5 years. And at the same time, work will continue on the issue of labor mobility in a way of making it easier for people to exercise their right of freedom of movement, but also in a way to make it so that everyone perceives the system as being fair and that they can draw the maximum that they can for them, including young people. In that sense, I only mentioned Erasmus. I know that there are also the other programs which help, and even more, we are thinking of how to even more help the matching, let's say, the matching across Europe between demand and supply, basically. I can stop at that.
The question of the gentleman?
I'm not the one. I think I've answered the question by going back to the point that it is not about social policy. The idea, what we are really talking about, is about whether there is a need of a macroeconomic stability mechanism for the EMU, which can be through unemployment insurance, but it could be something else. So this is what we're talking about, and we're not talking about social policy or solidarity between member states in that sense. Was that clear enough? Did I answer the question?
Thank you.
Okay.
So on.
To touch upon the issue of solidarity and the left behind. Unemployment and insurance scheme won't solve it all, and we definitely need to focus more on a social investment package, meaning that we might want to think about also training rights attached to the person, on a set of skills, on useful skills that could be benchmarked, including through cooperation between countries, social players, and of course renovated training systems. But we do need this form of active solidarity if we want to help southern countries redress their competitiveness, if we want eastern countries to catch up, if we want to accompany the environmental transition and fund growth. Definitely non-formal education are key to provide more appropriate training tools.
Thank you. Miroslav.
Thank you. On the U.S., Europe, and subsidiarity, and that also links to the German question of whether Germans would be willing to send money to Italian workers or Slovak workers. The U.S. has a system, basically a two-tier system, where you have state-level funds, which, however, in case they are in deficit, the federal level basically lends them money. I mean, it gives them money, but after several years, that needs to be paid back. So the U.S. has a fairly strict system whereby states determine that. But on the top of that, U.S. has a discretionary federal system where in times of recession, basically the Congress comes together and says, we're going to, you know, do emergency unemployment benefits, and then we're going to extend them and extend them and extend them, as we have seen in this recession. And if you look at the extent of that fiscally, that's in recessions, that's actually quite a major stabilization tool. In our designs and our analysis, we have said that this is impossible institutional design for Europe because, you know, that would be extremely transaction costly for the European Parliament and Council to be getting together in difficult times and hashing out the nature of emergency benefits in that time. So our contention is that any system in Europe needs to be automatic. So, in the sense that both the sort of state level, or in our case, member state level, and this sort of redistributory emergency level need to be fairly automatic, otherwise it's never going to work in Europe as it is at the moment. on the issue of Germany and, you know, the nature of solidarity in Europe, I mean, my personal view is that that's why I think a reinsurance idea is both much more viable and better and for Europe than the true supranational unemployment insurance, because I think if you want to do supranational unemployment insurance, you will either not get it at all, it will just not be approved and it will kill the idea of European unemployment insurance, or you will get it in a very small form which will not make any difference as a part of some horse trading. I mean, remember, we have a globalization fund as well in Europe, which hasn't made any difference to anyone, but, you know, but it's been created and it exists. So, you know, I couldn't exclude that there would be something called European unemployment insurance, but it would probably be just something very, very unimportant and small. So that's my personal view. That's why I think the reinsurance idea is the only way to go politically. And last bullet point is on the question of the unemployment insurance and poverty, which was asked earlier. And I think that is precisely the point of the unemployment insurance, especially the reinsurance idea, which is that if you are as a country in a pickle, if you are Spain and your bubble has just burst in a spectacular way and, you know, your revenue is drying up and you are under immense pressure, whether from Brussels or from the financial markets or both, you know, it would be really very helpful at that point to be getting a significant chunk of free cash for the national government to spend on stabilization. And why I'm saying free chunk is because I don't believe in over-conditionalizing that, because I think there's a big debate whether you should have, let's say, European unemployment benefits, which would be ring-fenced from the rest of the budget. But that means that those people who would be getting them would be getting some very nice European blue benefits, but the rest of them would be sort of drawing the Greek benefits or the Slovak benefits. And I think that could actually polarize the society more than help it. So that's why I think you really need to have chunk of cash, which is significant. Country needs to get it when it's really in trouble, and then the government should have a fair amount of leeway on how it's going to spend it. I mean, you can create some broad boundaries for that, but I don't think you should micromanage it from Brussels or from Berlin or from whenever. Thank you.
And finally, Gregory.
Thanks for letting me conclude. First, I have to say that I'm very happy to see that there seems to be like a consensus on the fact that we need a stabilization mechanism at the EMU level, and even the Commission says so. I agree also that the European Unemployment Insurance Scheme is not the only possibility. I would be very happy also if we had like a stabilization mechanism with a fiscal capacity at the EMU level. That would be also level. But in a way, what I like about the European Unemployment Insurance Scheme is that it also gives like a social dimension to European policy that has been missing, and that is often because European policy is often seen as very technocratic or technical. We have been creating a monetary union, which for people is very abstract. Competition policy is also very abstract. So I think in a way, an unemployment insurance at the European level would make it more concrete for people, and it would also change maybe the image of the European Union. So I think that's also a reason why it may be worse to have such a European unemployment insurance. And just I'd like to conclude maybe on a remark that Ruth made about the segmentation of the labor market between insiders and outsiders. And saying that maybe less protection is needed for the insiders and more protection for the outsiders, it can be part of the problem. I agree that sometimes in some countries it can be part of the problem. But this segmentation of the labor market may also be more linked, like, to the globalization of the labor market. Because, for example, if you look at the U.S. or the U.K., where the protection is lower for workers and where labor markets are much more flexible, in the end you also seem to see like a kind of a segmentation between high-skilled workers that have good wages, long-term contracts, good benefits, and low-skilled workers that have low wages, short-term contracts, and no benefits. So in a way, I think that protection is one of the parameters that you need to touch, but maybe there are other parameters that are important to put an end to this segmentation, and maybe you can not even solve it. Maybe solve this problem because it's more globalized problem. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Now we are already running out of time, and so I am tempted to repeat what Etienne Davignon has said in concluding. It's complicated. We have to do something. But maybe I have a slightly different version. I would say there is no silver bullet that does it all. There's no panacea. careful design is crucially important of every policy that's been carried out. And especially you have to take a look at, on the one hand, formal convergence, and on the other hand, the factual convergence. And with this, I would like now to go over to the lunch, I think. It's outside. And, get a refresh. And we'll meet here again, I think, at 1:30. Thank you. Thank you to all the panelists.
Thank you. Thank you.